Hello and welcome to the Narrative for Social Justice podcast. My name is Chiara Pellegrini and today I'm chatting with Jemima Elliott, climate justice campaigner based in Newcastle in the northeast of England. Jemima is also a writer on climate justice and fast fashion and a postgraduate student in literature at Newcastle University. The episode was recorded last summer, so you will hear some seasonal references relevant to the themes that we discuss. Hi, welcome to the podcast. So do you want to introduce yourself?
So I'm Jemima. I'm a writer and a climate activist, working mostly with groups like Remake and Green New Deal Rising.
Yeah, do you want to tell us something about these groups?
So with Remake, our work centres around the fashion industry and like environmental and workers' justice in the fashion industry, with campaigns like the Pay Up campaign, in signing the international accord, mostly to get workers paid by brands and to just transform the garment industry. And then with Green New Deal Rising, Green New Deal Rising is a youth climate justice organisation working in the UK to achieve a Green New Deal, which is a 10-year game-changing plan to tackle the climate crisis and create a world in which we can thrive. And we do that in loads of different ways. We do MP challenges to try and get MPs to sign the Green New Deal bill that is in early stages in Parliament at the moment, to challenges to either celebrate MPs who are taking action or to expose politicians and other people in power for climate delaying and deliberately risking our futures. So we've done challenges with, I don't know how many off the top of my head, but many politicians now, including Priti Patel, Rishi Sunak. Yeah, we've spoken to Rishi many times.
So what do the challenges consist in? Do you just go up to them?
Yeah, basically. Okay. Yeah, we kind of varying degrees. So we'll find where they are in public. Yeah, when they're in public spaces, whether that's events or if we see them on the street. So a few weeks ago, I challenged Chiomwera, the Newcastle Central MP, because I was just walking down the street with some Green New Deal Rising friends of mine. And we went, let's do a challenge. Wow. And just kind of challenged her on the spot. It was a very frustrating conversation. She said she wouldn't sign it, but she supported the Green New Deal, which is very frustrating. So she's going to be hearing more from us soon. And we'll kind of plan them out if we know an MP is going to be in a certain place. So my second ever challenge was with Rishi Sunak. We went to a dinner that he was having at, we managed to speak to him, and he went through a play park to try and avoid us because we were at all of the entrances. So we did manage to speak to him, as well as lots of the people who were there attending the event, and made a bit of noise outside as well.
Do you have an example of a time where it's worked the way that you were expecting it?
Definitely. So in December, I was part of a group who challenged Tim Farron, the Lib Dem MP in Newcastle. And we had a really good conversation with him. He said that it was a very hopeful conversation. And he said that he was 99% sure that he would sign it. So we were kind of very positive afterwards. And then in emails later on, he said that he wouldn't. But then after we kind of got lots of people from his constituency who are part of Green New Deal Rising and kind of knew other people again in his constituency to email a lot, as well as some of the other challengers, emailing after a lot of badgering, he's then now signed the bill. And most Lib Dem MPs have now signed the Green New Deal bill.
Wow.
So that's kind of something that has worked. It does go well sometimes.
That's really interesting. Yeah. And so do you have a sort of local branch with a number, how many people are involved in this as a general ballpark?
Maybe 1,000 people. I can't remember off the top of my head, but there's lots of people who are involved with various different degrees. So some people who do a lot every week, or some people who've maybe just been along to a challenge or done smaller bits here and there. So there are lots and lots of people involved, and it's been growing massively. Green New Deal Rising only started last August.
So because this is a podcast about narrative, I'm going to ask you about how narrative comes into it. How would you say that narrative, in whatever way you want to conceptualize this, comes into the work that you do?
Well, definitely my work as a writer on climate justice issues, obviously that's kind of a bit more obvious. But narrative is a huge part of kind of what we do within GNDR. Like, it's part of our challenges as well. And we discuss this a lot within the group, of like personal stories and how we are personally affected by the climate crisis, by like the cost of living, all of these things that are affecting all of us. And we make that a key part of the challenges as well. So when we're talking to MPs and other people in power, we'll be like, well, I'm Jemima, I'm 22 years old, I'm scared about the climate crisis and my future for these like XYZ, whatever a kind of personal experiences. For me, as my personal narrative in relation to the climate crisis is, like, I grew up in Pembrokeshire, which is very coastal Welsh county. I grew up within 5 minutes drive of the beach. Like, in my secondary school, you could see the sea from my classrooms. And because of the climate crisis, like, I know there's going to be a day when so many places that are really important to me and special to me are just not there anymore. I'm going to be kind of overtaken by rising sea levels, and that's terrifying. And I feel like I'm kind of was the last generation to be able to enjoy that space. Because I remember seeing, I think, a girl who must have been maximum 10 years old, a video of her doing a speaking on a Fridays for Future strike in my home county, and just kind of crying at that video because she doesn't get to enjoy it in the way that I did. And like, my grandparents still live in Pembrokeshire, and again, right up by the coast, and the campsite near them has been flooded for many years. It's gradually been flooded. Mm-hmm. And I thought the rising sea levels was the main thing that I'd have to worry about. But after the new heat, like the heat wave in the UK the other week, where we got up to 40 degrees, which is ridiculous and unheard of, the grasslands on the cliff near where they live was on fire for 3 days. And I never thought I'd have to worry about wildfires with them being right on the coast in rural Wales. But now I have to worry about both rising sea levels and wildfires for my grandparents to just be safe and kind of live happily. Personal narratives like that, and because everyone has some kind of narrative of how it affects them and why they're concerned and why action needs to be taken. So I haven't had a chance to speak to a politician about that specific experience and narrative just yet.
But that's going to the top of the list.
That's going to be there because I feel like that's huge. So, and it's, yeah, a way that our personal stories evoke action.
Do you think that there's something about confronting a person face to face with a personal story, and also the affects and feelings that are associated with it? Really? It seems to be like a key strategy of the group, right?
Yeah, it really is. Because I feel like if you can be oblivious, oh yeah, climate crisis, politicians can be like, oh yeah, that's something that's happening, it's not something that we need to worry about. Whereas I'm like, the fire near my grandparents' house is literally on fire for days. What are you going to do about it? It makes it seem more urgent, and to show that people are actually being affected right now. Because, I mean, the government they've just approved the Jackdaw gas field, which is in the North Sea, funded by and run by Shell. And that's going to produce the same emissions as half of Scotland and the entirety of Ghana, which is terrifying. And we can't do that. So it's like, when we're having heat waves like this and experiences like this, they need to hear those narratives.
Seems like as well, age seems to come into it as well, because obviously the group is young people. Mm-hmm. So do you want to say a bit more about that and kind of how that relates to the personal stories and the urgency of the issue?
I think age does really come into it. I think because, let's say, with where I grew up, being probably the last generation to actually enjoy my surroundings and the beach and the countryside worry-free, because I wasn't really thinking about the climate crisis when I was 10 years old, whereas like the girl who I saw in the video was striking out and not going to school because of it, because she wanted action to be taken. Whereas I could just go to the beach with my friends. And yeah, I mean, the younger you are, the more affected you're going to be by the climate crisis. So I know so many people who've made sacrifices to be able to work to prevent further climate catastrophe and not pursued their dreams. One of my friends, they really wanted as a child to be an engineer, and they've studied to become an engineer, but that's not what they're doing now. Is they're changing paths to work full-time in campaigning. And I know that the same with so many people are sacrificing like joy and relationships and so many things because they're terrified. We haven't had the chance to like just live.
Obviously, you mentioned that you're a writer as well, so how do you see like the relationship between you writing about climate justice and your more confrontational work. Or I guess if you do consider it more confrontational, yeah. I guess I'm thinking of a physical distance from the person who's going to receive the words.
I guess it is very different from actually physically confronting, or virtually. We've done online challenges as well. So we've done several Zoom bombs with Priti Patel now as well. Yeah. So yeah, I spoke directly to Priti Patel over a Zoom call. Often with the challenges, you can get a lot of adrenaline. You can't necessarily always remember everything and kind of forget stuff and panic. And you may know exactly the story, but panic a little bit. So, which I'm still getting used to and still trying to learn how to deal with that. For example, with the Priti Patel challenge that I did, it was just one kind of question that I had written down in like preparation that I asked her. And then that was kind of it. Whereas with other challenges, yeah, the adrenaline, and even with that, I was jumping up and down after I got kicked off a Zoom call, and just like, it took me a long time to calm down. And the same with lots of the others, you just get a lot of adrenaline. Whereas, yeah, with writing, you're able to slow down a bit and get all the facts in and order it and edit and make sure you're happy.
It's almost like you are expected, in order to make an argument that is persuasive, you are expected to do things in the right order, to present your story in an intelligible and coherent manner, and hit all the right points. And but that can be really difficult to do on the fly.
I think with the challenges, that's one of the, sometimes part of what works is, you know, it doesn't have to be perfect, because that's part of it, is just, we're just people and we are scared, and that can come across. I mean, I think people have got emotional in challenges before, and like that, almost the lack of perfectedness in that can add more to it as well, because it shows our real, like, how much we care. And yeah, whereas I think with writing as well, like with my articles, like I write regularly for Remake, and I've also written for like Shadow Mag and various other places, as well as on my blog. But those articles are very, I think, for a very different audience, because obviously the challenge has a very specific, we're challenging you because we want you to do this, like we need you to do this. Whereas with writing, it's kind of, it's on those topics, but it's more for just everyone, and to kind of, to get people to take more action as well, and to understand, like I write a lot about fashion, mostly to discuss why fast fashion using secondhand kind of wings of their brand is just greenwashing and not actually doing anything productive. And the same with donations and stuff, and kind of to look beyond what the brand's telling us and what they're actually doing, for that to lead to more take part in campaigns like Pay Up, or No New Clothes, which is something that Remake does every year. It's like a 3-month, like over the summer, so like more than halfway through that now, No New Clothes, where people either don't buy anything at all, which is kind of what I'm doing, or you don't buy anything new, so you can just buy secondhand. That's something that Remake does every year as a way for people to think about their clothing consumption, to slow down. But yes, I think the work I do in terms of my writing is a way to get kind of consciousness raising and awareness.
It sounds to me like there's both a larger audience, but also a less defined one.
Yeah.
And do you feel like the action that you can inspire with what you're communicating, do you think that feels less immediate because of the distance of the writing, or is it in a immediate in a different way?
Yeah, I think I often forget that people actually read it as well. So when someone says that they've read my article or really liked it, I'm like, oh, cool, thank you. I forgot that people can still read that. That's not just something I sent off into the ether, which is always great. And I mean, I've had family members say that they stopped buying clothes or taking part in No New Clothes as a result of like reading some of the articles that I've done. Yeah, it's always really lovely when people say that they've kind of enjoyed or learned something.
But it's
that.
Kind of unexpected, because it doesn't feel like you have someone in front of you.
No, I can't visibly see people reading it. Whereas with the challenge, you can see someone's reaction and continue that dialogue with them for a little bit. But yeah, with the writing, it is a more long-lasting thing as well, because of the internet. Like, it just, people go back to it and find, like, people I've never met will find that article maybe months after I've written it. It's a long-lasting thing, but does push people to do things. So it's the lack of immediacy.
And do you think that the kind of information and or narrative that you communicate through writing is different than the, I'm assuming, briefer bits of information that you can communicate in a face-to-face challenge.
Yeah, definitely. And you can provide sources as well. So it's like the narrative beyond what you're just saying. And then people can look into that themselves and create their own narrative, I guess, of what's happening.
Does personal narrative come into the writing, or to a lesser extent?
It depends what I'm writing on. So I did a piece on science-based targets and how brands aren't like making targets and using that to advertise themselves as kind of eco-conscious, but then not meeting those targets at all. So really, that's not actually doing anything for it. So what's happening there? Yeah, and like that wasn't really personal at all. It's just kind of a bit more analytical and looking at numbers and statistics and things. Whereas if I'm writing on my experience with No New Clothes, for example, which I did last year, that's obviously a lot more personal. I'm kind of looking at my own feelings towards consumption and what I've internalized and kind of my like internalized capitalism and like all of those things, or how like I just wanted to scroll when I saw like an ethical company were doing a sale, or just scroll and then go, I'm not going to buy these, so why am I looking? Even though it's technically a good company, I don't need the clothes or want the clothes, I just look nice looking at pretty things. There's a lot of things that are really personal in it. So if we're talking about like the most recent article I wrote for Remake was on the secondhand industry and how that's a neo-colonial manifestation. The vast majority of clothes that get donated end up in landfills and secondhand markets across the global south. So 70% of all clothes that are donated end up in Africa somewhere. A big hub is in Accra in Ghana. So there's the Kantamanto market, which is like the biggest secondhand market of clothes, and a lot of stuff that gets shipped there can't be actually reused or upcycled or sold on again because it's not in a condition to be sold on. So it's dirty, broken, and there are fires as a result of the massive landfills there, which has, I think, in the past year, I talk about this more in the article as well, there's like people like lost their homes because of those fires, like people working on the landfills and the markets. The workers there aren't able to keep up with the demand of the amount of clothes that are coming in. So it's not necessarily my narrative that I'm always focusing on, but it's the workers' narrative as well and what's happening to them and their experiences. So if they will buy a shipping container with the clothes to sell on or to upcycle and then sell on, but they don't know what will be in that at all. So there's just a massive gamble. Yeah, a lot of it won't be able to use. So that's kind of a whole chunk that will just go straight to landfill because they can't do anything with it because of the kind of disregard of consumers in the global north.
Yeah. And it sounds to me that presenting this kind of narrative also acts as a counter narrative to the narrative that the companies themselves
definitely,
are presenting.
Yeah. Yeah, definitely.
So is there a sense in which companies are presenting themselves as not participating in the destruction of fast fashion, what they actually are?
Yeah. With H&M, for example, they're a massive greenwasher. Like, they produce so many clothes and say they really care about the climate. They're one of the ones who kind of did one of the first eco lines. So their conscious collection, yeah, which is such a small part of what
in,
they
like,
do.
In what way is it?
They have organic cotton or partly organic cotton, and apparently that's fine. whereas they, yeah, there's no evidence that they pay their workers properly. Right. They're creating more and more each year and are bragging about that growth. Like, I think I saw their CEO, a post by the CEO or someone working within their kind of top companies planning on making even more in the next year. And it's like, if you actually do care about the planet and your workers, then you wouldn't be doing that. You'd be focusing on degrowth. Yeah. And they also kind of, well, fail to mention that their workers are dying in their supply chains. Like Jayasri Kathirabel, who was 21, she died. She was murdered over a year and a half ago now, like on New Year's Day, I think last year. And she was sexually harassed, assaulted, and murdered by her supervisor. And lots of people from the same factory then came forward afterwards. I think about 20 people saying about similar experiences, which is awful. And that narrative is being kind of pushed down and forgotten about when it's International Women's Day, and brands like H&M love to say how feminist they are. And it's, yeah, while 80% of garment workers are young women and only 2% of garment workers earn a living wage, where's the feminism in that?
would you call what you do social justice? Is this a term that you relate to?
Yeah, I think so. I kind of more use the term like climate justice, but I think they're quite interchangeable. But with climate justice, it's more of an emphasis on the fact that the climate crisis is caused by all of these systems of oppression. Yeah, so it's like the same harms and the same solutions within social justice, but focusing on how that's also contributes and tactics, I suppose, to solve the climate crisis at the same time.
Slightly different emphasis, maybe.
Yeah, I think, yeah, just slightly different emphasis just because of the massive threat that people are facing at the moment. Because, yeah, I think social justice to me is like with the Green New Deal, like a world where everyone can thrive and just enjoy life without kind of those barriers. And yeah, that's not possible without tackling the climate crisis. So I think it's really important that emphasis needs to be there. So yeah, I'd say it definitely does, like social justice does definitely apply to my work, but I tend to use the phrase climate justice.
Because we've talked about writing as well, and you are, I guess, in the academic world to some extent, how do you view for yourself the relationship between activism and academia?
They're very linked for me personally. I can't imagine doing my research without that being very linked to social justice and like my activism. So like I've always done a big focus on feminism and more recently like police and prison abolitionist feminism. Yeah, because in my research I look at late Victorian early 20th century sensation detective novels through contemporary feminism and mostly prison abolitionist feminism. And while abolitionism might seem very different from the work that I do, I think it's incredibly related because the systems of like police and the carceral system as a whole, it's incredibly relevant to the climate crisis as well. And if you're looking at the marginalized and who's affected by those and who's affected by the climate crisis, and also the fact that protest is being increasingly criminalized in the UK. Yeah, I know several people have been to me like, how have you not been arrested yet? And I'm like, I don't know. But I'm also friends of mine will do actions that they're very aware that they will be arrested. And I kind of don't do those actions because and do things in a different way, but it's still we're all working in the same different parts of the movement in those senses. But for me, like I do a lot of work with children as well, and whether that's working with refugee and asylum seeking children in Newcastle or working with children to discuss like the right to protest, for example, like that's really important to me. And I think it has a huge impact as well. And it's also just where I get a lot of joy as well. I love working with the kids that I do. So I'm part of a circus club with a local group called Northeast Solidarity and Teaching. And I've worked with them for like 3.5 years now in different capacities and projects, but all the time really working with kids there. And yeah, over lockdown, we've done cohort clubs and circus clubs started in lockdown. And we've learned to juggle and do some other circus tricks like spinning plates and just basically like a youth club, essentially. Yeah. But it's really fun for us and them as well, and creates like a community and space for them to talk about things and to kind of just be kids as well. So for me, like both parts of my work are so important to me, but I don't want to get arrested because I know that will risk some of the other things that I've done and can do regularly that I know make a huge impact. So I kind of leave some of those actions to like some of my other friends who don't do that work and are happy to do that. And that I do like the other bits that are still really important, like the challenges and my writing, I feel like has been really impactful to people in getting them to take action as well. So I think there's, yeah, it's looking at all of the different sides of the movement as well and how everyone can take part. But yeah, my academia, like I've learned so much about abolitionism and feminism, and those are so important to me and how you look at social justice issues.
So in terms of like acquiring knowledge that can be applied or can inform
I think my acquiring the knowledge that informs my action and also like my non-academic writing as well, those research skills and learning from other people as well in academic spaces and how I can apply that, because I think someone who learn a lot from is like Angela Davis, and she's such a great example of how academia and activism just go so hand in hand.
There can be a tendency sometimes in academia to apply very broadly this sense of activism, that the very fact of writing academic articles or books is activism.
Yeah.
And I think there's always something a bit more that is needed.
There's more. And it also depends who's reading them. If we're kind of just in our own echo chambers in reading articles and going, oh yes, that's right. But then who's actually reading that? Exactly. And it needs to be shared to people who aren't necessarily in those circles but might want to learn about that. And my undergrad dissertation, for example, I ended up writing an article about on that topic for Shadow Mags. It was on the like gender-based violence and climate crises in Disney films, actually. But kind of looking at real life, the representations in those films like Moana, Maleficent and Frozen is mirrored in real life. So I wrote a kind of shortened article on that. And then lots of my friends and other people, again, it's not just my friends who read my articles, but they're the ones who will talk to me about it more. You know, said they learned a lot from that. And
it's translating the depth of research that you are able to do in an academic setting onto like a wider platform so that they can inform more than the five other academics who will read your academic publication.
Yeah, definitely.
But now you work, I guess in a sense you work with the past.
Yes.
So how do you see this relationship between the very urgent and contemporary focused activities that you do and looking at literature of the past?
I think one thing that Angela Davis says in Our Prison's Obsolete that I find really fascinating, she talks about like the rise of the novel as we know it is parallel with the rise of the police and prison system. So that's kind of just one thing that I think there's always that link and kind of looking at those things in parallel. With the action we're trying to take now, I don't think that can be effective if we're not looking at where it's rooted in and where it's coming from. Or something like the climate crisis, which is ultimately caused by colonialism and capitalism, then we need to look back to those things and kind of see how they've developed, and we need to understand those things to actually solve those issues. I think looking at the past is so important to understand them.
Do you think that novels specifically, like what do novels do in a positive way or in a negative way? Do you think they can do things?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, the narratives, whose narratives are being told, how are they being told, and like who's prioritized and what's being discussed in those as well. And often like you can kind of empathize and see what's happening with other people that whose experiences you will never have but might be very valid and informing, like an important and informing what you're doing or how you see a certain issue. Understanding past perspectives can really help look at something different, even if it doesn't necessarily seem connected. I feel like there's always a way to connect it. Sometimes I say that I'm looking at detective novels and Agatha Christie and stuff when I'm challenging Priti Patel like one week, then reading Agatha Christie the next, people are like, how is that linked? I'm like, it's all together, part of the whole. Looking at the carceral system as a whole and like the policing bill and detectives and how that runs and like the judicial system. So it makes me feel kind of hypocritical because I really love detective stories but really like absolutely so opposed to the police.
Really interesting. I guess I've never thought about it, but it's an issue.
It's my like guilty abolitionist
and you're looking at to critique it. Yes. But in the meantime you're
also enjoying the story.
I think that's pretty much everything. Do you want to tell us where people can find you on the internet?
We'll put
the links on our bibliography as well.
Cool. My blog is Another Ranting Reader. If you search Jemima Elliott, you might be able to find me on Instagram. I'm Another Ranting Reader on Twitter, A Ranting Reader. And if you want to have a look at Green New Deal Rising, it's GND Rising it's our website and like most social media platforms as well.
Yeah, thank you very much.
It was really fun.
Thank you for listening to this episode of the Narrative for Social Justice podcast. You can reach out to us at our email address, narrative4sj@gmail.com. That's the number 4. We are also on Twitter at narrative4sj, again with the number 4. And our Facebook page is called Narrative for Social Justice.